And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Chanel Benz to the program today. Her short stories have appeared in Guernica, Granted.com, Electric Literature's Recommended Reading, The American Reader, Fence, and The Cupboard, and she's received an O. Henry Prize. Today we'll be talking about her debut collection of stories, The Man Who Shot Out My Eye Is Dead, which is published by Echo HarperCollins. Chanel, most of the stories in the collection are historically set, many coming in the 19th century. What attracts you to writing historical fiction?
Well, I think in part of it was when I was a kid. I mean, I loved any kind of historical drama. I loved being transported to other worlds, you know, whether they were historical or fantastical. But I think pretty early on, I don't know if it was conscious, but I think pretty early on I realized that me as a young brown girl, that I wasn't present in a lot of these stories. So I think in a way I had to find a way to kind of insert myself into history. And so some of these characters are maybe an attempt at that, and some of them are just sort of outsiders or people whose stories may have not been told.
So many of the stories are set in the 19th century. What about that particular century intrigues you?
I don't know. It might be the English woman in me, you know, just kind of growing up on, you know, reading a lot of Jane Austen and things set in that period. My grandmother, who was Irish, she was always reading like Georgette Hare historical romance novels and things that were always set in the 19th century. So for me, it's something that I find pretty accessible.
Most of the stories are first-person narrators. Why do you choose that approach?
It might have a little to do with my acting background, just in the way that I'm building a character. It's sometimes easier for me to initially go to that first person, to the I, because it's immediate and because I can kind of speak out the cadence.
Now, did you study writing and acting concurrently, or did you do acting before writing or vice versa?
I did acting first. I was always writing, but acting, I studied theater mainly for my undergrad. And it wasn't until much later that I decided to actually formally study writing and be serious about it.
Do you think your experience with creating a backstory for your characters helped you get inside the heads when doing non-dialogue type writing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I went to a program that was very sort of hippie, but it was also kind of like an actor's boot camp. You know, they tried to break you down and make you aware of the way that you move through space, the way that you speak, you know, where that pitch is, how you breathe, how you walk, what part of your body you lead from. Is it your nose? Is it your chest? All of your habits. And they tried to sort of strip you of them so that you could build a character. And so when you were building a character, you thought of all these things that sort of make people the way they are. And I think that they really focused on sort of what it means to communicate as a storyteller, what it means to be a vehicle for story. And I think that definitely came into my writing. You know, it kind of makes me think, or I've been thinking lately about the theater director, Peter Brook. He's a kind of seminal British director, even though he works out of Paris now. And when I was studying theater, he was a huge figure to me. And recently I looked him up because I've started thinking about, you know, what is that connection for me between writing and acting? And he has a quote, which I'm going to sort of misquote here, but it has to do with, he was talking about theater, but having the closeness of reality and the distance of myth, that's what you're going after. And I feel like that's what I want in my own stories, that closeness of reality, that intimacy that feels real, but also the distance of myth, you know, something larger.
Well, and you write so effectively in the speech, the grammar, the vocabulary of the day, which is just a bit alienating to a reader since it is not of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of takes a little bit of that closeness out of the way, I think.
Yeah, and I think it also allows me to get away with some maybe drama that is a little more challenging when you're in contemporary period. You know, I can be kind of more over the top with the amount of action that happens in the stories.
Did you study Shakespeare in classical theater? Because with the last story in the collection, That We May All Be of One Sheepfold, was just right before Shakespeare's time when it was set.
Yeah, we did study a lot of Shakespeare, and we have Boston University, where I went for undergrad, has a sister school, the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts, so we spent a semester there. It was pretty grueling. We had 16 classes a week, and we did everything. We did clown, we did flamenco, we did Shakespeare, we did period dance, we did all kinds of stuff, which is sort of like stylized walking, really. And I think that, you know, I've been asked the question quite a bit, like, how is my work affected by Shakespeare? And at first I'm pretty stumped, you know. I think that it obviously must, but I wasn't sure exactly. And I think that it's really, when, as an actor, when you're learning the verse, you're learning the iambic pentameter, you're learning the rhythm, and the rhythm really helps you to memorize, but you're also learning, you know, you spend time kind of just going through, like, the consonants of a sentence or the vowels of a sentence, and the vowels are where the emotion is and the consonants are the meaning. That language becomes very physical. You know, it becomes the way that you vocally paint a scene, but it also becomes the way that you feel your way into the rhythm of a character. And I think that that's something that I'm trying to do in my own writing as well, is have language be this kind of muscular, physical thing so that the reader is feeling themselves into this world.
Well, I was just happy I'd read Shakespeare, so I knew what a coney was in that story. that's a rabbit.
Oh, and then I was going to say that I had actually never gone that far back. And that last story, Sheepfold, is set in the 16th century. So it was actually a lot more work for me to do the research to figure out, okay, what did happen in the dissolution of the monastery so that I can actually move with a little bit of authority.
How odd that story is very timely now, since President Trump's advisor, Steve Bannon, has described himself as Cromwell.
I mean, I am feeling a lot of timeliness, a lot of echoes right now in the things that I'm working on.
He should well remember what happened to Cromwell.
Yes.
Now, on the other hand, the story Recognition has a near future setting.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was it like, instead of taking elements of the past, trying to develop a path that might happen in the future?
Well, when I wrote it, I was thinking about man-made deserts, which is beginning to happen in certain areas more and more. You know, the land becomes, in some way, the water table becomes corrupted. Certain areas of the land become poisoned, and there are, you know, they become places that no longer grow any kind of vegetation. So I was thinking of a kind of man-made desert, and I started looking on, you know, different kinds of housing. People, I was looking on, like, survivalist boards, and you get all kinds of people on there. You know, you get people who are kind of utopianists. You get people who are, I don't even know what you call, I forgot what you call people who are thinking that the end of the world is coming, you know.
Tribulationists?
There's like some different kind of slogans, but you get people that have finally escaped debt and don't want that for their kids, so they decide that they're going to go and build them a house. You know, you get all kinds of people who are interested in kind of getting off the grid, basically. So I started reading all these different boards and looking at these different things and thinking about, what would it be like if this was normal? You know, that these kind of man-made deserts were normal, these kind of limitations that you encounter in these off-the-grid places would be normal, and that the kind of common world we know now, or we see, or maybe suburban America, if that was the past, the distant past. And so that's when I started writing this story.
And there's kind of an approach you have in a few of the stories, including that one, that there's kind of this mediated experience. So we have the mediated experience of that past, of the future. Also in the peculiar narrative of the remarkable particulars of the life of Arenda Thomas, we have an introduction by a scholar. In another story, we have footnotes that are attached to the story. This approach to kind of the story is coming through another lens that you are also writing. What is that approach to you?
I think in all of the stories, it comes down to you have the first person narrator, and they can only tell you the story from their direct experience. They can't tell you certain things about themselves. They can't tell you what happens to them in the end. You know, with the slave narrative, there might be ones that don't have it, but all of the ones I've ever read, they always have an editor. Now, in the past, an editor was usually somebody who was white and usually an abolitionist who's saying, what this person is telling you is true, it is authentic, it happened, I stand by them, you know, they're a good person. They're usually making a kind of moral case for this story and for that person, which I use in mind too, but I also make the case for, this is what happened to her. Which she can't tell you, right? She can't tell you in the end what happened to her. And with the other footnotes, it's sort of like, you know, in the Adela story, that the children can only sort of present their version of her. And the footnotes can kind of give you more of a social or historical context.
Who was the person writing the footnotes in Adela?
kind of an over-sexualized post-colonial scholar. So I'm definitely like poking fun at a lot of those kind of footnotes as well that you get in those texts, or just kind of some of the scholarship, which some of it's wonderful and some of it's absolutely insane, you know, when they're kind of laying on top of history and texts.
You mentioned I'm an amateur in studying Shakespeare. In The Peculiar Narrative of Orenda Thomas, the layout of the page isn't double justified like all the other stories are. So is her recounting supposed to be verse in that way?
Not verse, but like a diary form. Just I wanted it to be sort of different because the way that we usually get those slave narratives, they look different on the page. You know, the front page is sort of like almost like a newspaper print of those days, or like a poster, you know. And the rest, I wanted it to be in this kind of narrower kind of diary letters look.
And with that one, Adela, which the full title is Adela, primarily known as The Black Voyage, reprinted as Red Casket of the Heart, and then the last story as well, you have these really long titles. So what attracts you to like these really full titles?
It's partly of the period, but I think they just kind of came to me in a rush, you know, all the different things that you could call them. You know, we may be one sheepfold, or, and then there's a Latin term that I'm not even going to try to read because I haven't practiced it, but it's, you know, the most corrupt of the centuries, the most corrupt century. And so I think that I like those kind of juxtapositions of, you know, sort of old-fashioned titles where it could be this, it could be that, it could be this, but it's all of those things. But also, I think, you know, when stories have been around a long time, they often have different titles, you know, depending on the publisher putting them out.
Mm. The most corrupt centuries, of course, being in play again today.
Yeah.
Just with her name, Orenda Thomas, it made me think of the Joseph Boyden book, The Orenda, which came out a couple of years ago, the Canadian writer. And I looked up and to see if Orenda had a meaning, and it's like this, the concept of the living spirit and animating power for the Iroquois people.
Interesting. You know, I've met Joseph before a long time ago, just kind of in passing, and I haven't got a chance to read that book, but I didn't know that about her name.
The other spelling is O-R-E-N-D-A.
Mm-hmm.
She has a lot of spirit. She is a woman who was enslaved and is now a prominent poet in the 1830s or 40s in America.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lot about Phyllis Wheatley. You know, I think she was in the 17th century black poet, and what it meant to kind of not be enslaved and be a poet, but be a black poet, and the kind of the freedoms and the privileges and the limitations of that. You know, and I guess what else I was sort of thinking about, too, is a lot of these figures, even people who wrote slave narratives that became very popular, or, you know, people who toured like Phyllis Wheatley and were a popular black poet in the 17th century, ended up poor and destitute. You know, a lot of their biographies at the end, they say, last reported, heard from, you know, 10 years later, we think they died here, or, you know, died destitute on the streets. And so it's a strange thing that at one point, they were held up as, you know, an exceptional example of their race, and they were freed in this way, and then they seemed to just be dropped, you know, or maybe the one person who was taking care of them died.
I don't know how he could think that taking a woman of African heritage to Louisiana to do a poetry reading in the 1840s would be a good idea.
Yeah. That character, Crawford, is mercenary, but I think like a lot of mercenary people, or a lot of kind of showman types, they convince themselves of a different narrative, which allows them to do morally slippery things.
Throughout the course of the stories, there are a lot of dying or dead parents that pop up. You don't have a good future if you have children in this book, it seems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how do I answer this one? I think I'm interested in part in the absence of parents, and what that does and what that means. And there's different kinds of absences. You know, there's the parent who's present but is absent. There's the parent who exists somewhere in the world but has abandoned their child. You know, there's the parent that, you know, passes on. And, you know, what that means when whatever our relationship may be to our parents, they're often like our literal roots, you know, the thing that grounds us. And I think that I was interested in that, and I think also just one of my ultimate fears, and it always has been since I was a little kid, would be to lose my mother. And I was always afraid of it. You know, I was always talking to her about it. kind of a strange, morbid thing, but I always would say, you know, Mom, if you die, I'm going to die too. And I think when I look back on that, it's just that childhood understanding of not being able to imagine being in the world without your parent, you know?
Well, and the one that struck me as perhaps the worst psychologically is the one in The Diplomat's Daughter, in which the mother isn't mentally capable of being a good parent.
Yeah. I mean, at first the mother was just kind of a comic character, and it took me a while to really think about what that would mean for the two girls, for Natalia and Mila, that, you know, I think Natalia says it at one point, for a moment she was the mother we've always wanted, but we could never have. You know, so to know that, you know, even in the moment that it seems like things are going to be different, they're usually not. Their mother doesn't actually want to change, you know.
And in that one, you have an unusual chronological sequencing. It's non-contiguous, mm-hmm. flashing back and forth. What effect were you trying to go with that, mixing time periods along that?
You know, the first part of that is the first part that came to me. And then I immediately kind of moved backwards to Natalia's past, to where she came from. You know, with that story, it was kind of like a deck of cards. I just kept writing different scenes from different parts of her life. So I literally put them on note cards and spread them out on the floor and just started moving around the order and tried to sort of feel out. And I actually have probably 6 versions of that story in which there's a different order because the kind of most important point is different, you know, whether it's her relationship with her sister or her relationship with her father or the relationship she has with Eric, the mercenary. It's actually, I think, my favorite story to work on because I felt like I could keep shuffling and I could keep adding in scenes, and I wasn't, in some ways, I didn't feel done with it. So I just kind of went with the one my agent liked the best. I usually tend to like the darker ones better. But I guess going along with the deck of cards, her identity always felt like such a shifting kind of protean thing. And so it made sense to me that to know her, it wouldn't make sense to go in a straight line. You know, she's like a puzzle. The pieces have to be out of order.
So how does that feel to let that story go, to know that it's perhaps somebody else's decision what its final form was taking?
I guess what I like about the short story is I don't feel that it ever needs to be perfect, is that there's so many different versions of stories. And I think, dare I say, that in a way we're always writing the same story, you know? And so for me, it just feels like, well, there's something in that that I'll probably revisit, but it will be in a different, you know, a different version. And I don't know. I mean, I think it comes up in theater a lot, where the playwright really has to let go. You know, you write your story as a playwright and then somebody goes and directs and acts it, and it cannot possibly be what you imagined. You know, you really have to let go. So I think I sort of accepted that early on.
So what do you view as the story that you keep writing over and over again?
This is a difficult one. I think that, you know, and I'm kind of stealing this thought from an interview I did earlier this week. Was it this week? Is today? I can't remember what day it is. With Dana Spiotta, where we were talking and I was talking about religion, not sort of like organized religion in the stories, but a kind of spiritual longing. Or I said that I felt like the characters are often trying to return to this simpler time in themselves that may or may not have really truly existed, but they're sort of longing for the moment when they were good.
And do you think you're good now, or do you think you were good prior?
I think I'm good now, but I think I'm more aware of my capabilities. Or prior, I maybe felt like, you know, when I was kind of younger, that it was sort of before I'd ever hurt anybody. You know, and when you're older, you have the weight of your sins, your mistakes, your stepping on people.
So is writing in a way an atonement or a way of negotiating your concept of self?
I think it's negotiating. Yeah, I think it's negotiating it, trying to figure it out. You know, and also when I was younger, I think I did have a kind of like patchwork spirituality of like Ralph Waldo Emerson, things I'd heard or read about God. I was raised Catholic-ish in England, but it was very kind of loose. So I liked ritual. I liked this idea of kind of a personal God like Jesus, kind of with you all the time, like your best friend. And when I grew out of that, I always had this remaining kind of hauntedness or sadness that I couldn't quite find something as, I don't want to say comforting because that sort of diminishes it, but something as, I don't know, beautiful or luminous or larger than myself.
But a constant presence?
Yeah. So it's kind of lonely without that, you know.
In one way of facing loneliness, especially as a writer, you attended the program at Syracuse, and you mentioned Dana Spiota, George Saunders, Memphian, Arthur Flowers. What would you say was the best thing that you learned in the program?
Gosh, I think to not be careful. I think that all three of those people taught me all the things that fiction could be, you know, and that there weren't limitations. So I came out of there wanting to do all the different things that fiction could possibly do.
What was the biggest preconception were you disabused of when you got there?
Probably that I was initially amazing. I really thought my work was pretty good going in, and very quickly I got to see that what the reader was reading and what I thought they were reading were different.
Can you talk about the last story that didn't make it into the collection?
Sure. That story was a post-apocalyptic story. Recognition I actually wrote very quickly. My editor gave me some notes on the story that didn't make it in, and she said, you know, the world, and I can't remember the other thing, the world isn't right. And I just thought, well, I can't fix that. You know, I've revised and revised and revised, and I really don't know how to fix this story. It might just be too old. It might just be too not really fixable. So I just told her. I said, I don't think I can fix this story. And I said, I have an idea for another story. And it was really like coming down to the wire to turn the book completely in. So I just quickly wrote Recognition, probably in like a week. You know, I stole some landscape things from that story. But it was a story about a robot girl who is living in this kind of like subterranean bunker with her father, who was an engineer, one of the engineers that made her. And he kidnapped her, and the kind of authorities have been constantly looking for her. So eventually he disappears one day and she goes out looking for him and ends up getting captured. But she also sort of uncovers the world in which she lived in. And so there's parts of that story I still really like. I still really like the relationship between her and the father, or the engineer father, and just sort of the quest concept.
With Recognition and the story That We May All Be One Sheepfold, it seems a lot of the stories kind of have like partners, and they're almost kind of paired up in a way. Hmm. And in that one, is that both have kind of these cloistered experiences when they're young, of living in the abbey or living in the isolated community.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I think like a lot of people, I've always been really interested in those experiences, you know, those cult-like experiences. But I've also always been really interested in monks or anchorites, who in the medieval era, when you decided to become an anchorite, you know, you lived in a kind of small room attached to the church for the rest of your life. You never left that room, and you just, you know, contemplated God. I mean, I couldn't imagine the day-to-day of that. And, you know, with monks, their life is on this sort of like hours calendar, and it's very rigorous, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, praying and contemplation and physical labor, but there's also a lot of, I don't know, deep spiritual beauty. I've just always been curious about that experience.
Knowing that in history, so many of these people were like members of the royal family who, it was against their will, became anchorites in an abbey. And I've just always wondered, what is the advantage of sealing that person up in a room and they have minimal human contact as opposed to just killing them outright? What is the moral difference in those?
Well, I guess if you're torturing somebody, that one's pretty bad. But I guess you just want, you don't necessarily want to kill them. You just want them away from the world. I don't know.
Now, there are actually two stories in the collection that feature someone getting shot in the eye.
I don't know where that came from. But, you know, when one of the characters says, you know, the man who shot my eye is dead, just kind of resonated with me in terms of a good kind of overarching title, oddly enough, for the whole book. I don't know. There's something about that phrase that I instantly kind of get a picture in my mind.
The other story that features that was West of the Known, in which a young woman is living with extended family and being abused terribly, and her half-brother comes to rescue her and then gets her involved with a life of crime. So what's the old Bob Dylan thing that live outside the law, you must be honest?
I think a lot of the characters is kind of, you know, out of the frying pan, into the fire. And I think that that's true. A lot of times when you're in a dire situation and you're trying to escape, you don't necessarily make good decisions, you know, and there aren't necessarily a lot of options open to you. It's just kind of a different kind of trouble.
In your acknowledgments, I saw that you think Baron Vaughn. Is that the actor and comedian Baron Vaughn?
Yeah, he's one of my best friends.
Did y'all meet in acting school?
We did. Yeah, we met at Boston University. He's a couple years ahead of me. And yeah, we're still in touch. I just talked to him yesterday. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Loved his podcast. I used to listen to it a couple
of
years
ago.
Oh, yeah?
I'll have to tell him.
And what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a novel right now. It's set in the Mississippi Delta. So it's kind of nice for me to be around here and kind of soak up a little bit more research. It goes back and forth in a way between 1971 and 2005, and it's about a woman who returns home. Well, she returns to the Delta where she was born, but she sort of hasn't grown up there, so sort of the stranger returns home. She's inherited her father's sharecropper shack. So her mother and father were two civil rights activists. Her father was a black arts poet. Her mother was a white student who ends up becoming a medievalist, and they, you know, got married and had her and got divorced. And at one point she had gone to stay with her father, as she did every summer as a child, and he died. And so years and years later, the house is finally filtered down to her and she returns home. And while she's there, she starts to realize that maybe the circumstances of her father's death are different than the ones she thought. So I've been doing a lot of research on, you know, the civil rights era, and before the civil rights era in the Delta, research on the black arts movement, but also just been thinking about, you know, when Freedom Summer was over, when the national attention left, and it was, you know, the early 70s, what was life like for people in these small Delta towns with, you know, complex familial relationships? What were the tensions? What were the hopes? What was going on?
Since we're so close to the Delta, we hope you get to come back and talk about us with it when you get that finished.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for stopping by today, Chanel.
Thanks for asking me.
Chanel Benz is the author of the short story collection, The Man Who Shot Out My Eye Is Dead, which is published by Echo HarperCollins. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com. Or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111. Or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.